Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the latest research about how just information giving is not enough for the listener to receive the facts. The story, as it is stated, drives the facts in. Then I'll speak to Dr. Jeffrey Zeig. He's a psychotherapist, the founder of Milton Erickson Foundation, and the author of more than 20 books. Today, we will be talking about the habit of being happy, especially we need it at this time of constantly being inside the fear. I'm on Twitter, Dr. Zain, and Instagram, Dr. Fujian Zain. Come on, go in there and talk to me, send me messages, and be a part of my social media. And also check me out on all of the podcasts in iTunes, Stitchers, all of it. I want to hear from you. We will be back with the tip of the week. Hello, this is Dr. Fujian Zain. For all of you who are interested in changing something in your life, or shifting a new career, or bettering your intimate relationship, or, you know, it's just time to take care of you, but you really don't have time to take off from your busy day, or you're just too far away from my Beverly Hills or San Clemente office, I have a great offer for you. I'm only offering this time-limited package to you. For online therapy, if you are living in the state of California, or online coaching, wherever you live around the world. Now listen, a 10-week package with a $500 discount. Call me to schedule your appointment, 818-648-2140, 818-648-2140, or go to Fujian.com, F-O-O-J-A-N.com, for more information. It's time to take care of you. Because you are worth it. So here's the tip of the week. I hope that you have had a stressless week. Although I know that with all the coverage about the coronavirus, it's hard not to feel the high stress that everyone's experiencing. I've been talking to many of my friends and clients about their experience past couple of weeks regarding the coronavirus. There are people who have totally minimized it and see it as a nuisance that does not allow them to be free and go wherever they want to go, meet and greet people as they like by shaking their hands or kissing them or hugging them. Others take a rebellious act as if they will break the virus down if they just take on the attitude of, I don't care, and go above and beyond touching and hugging and ridiculing and the uproar about it. Others think that I just have to protect my children and elderly, but don't need to take care of myself since I'm invincible and I will not catch it. Others think that if I just run from specific ethnicities, Chinese, Iranians, Italians, I'll be fine. Others have panicked, and although they're going about their regular life, they're just fearful and angry, and the threat of death that is constantly staring them in their face. And finally, others who have panicked and isolated themselves at home, and they go buy like tons and tons of toilet papers and bottled waters and canned food and everything because they're scared of people or socializing with them, and they're going to go and isolate themselves from every single human being. It's been tough for everyone to either experience having a cold or the flu and be afraid of their own life and feel responsible and guilty and a sense of shame to possibly be a carrier for someone else to become sick. I also have been the sight of fear in people's eye when someone has a cold or sniffle or coughs around them, and they'll just go like this or, oh my God. I mean, I've known people who are standing beside like a place and not letting people come in just because they're now scared of everyone. How are you handling these weeks? How has the coronavirus affected your life? And how does watching the news, gathering the news through social media and friends and family affect you? How are you taking care of yourself at this time? I know that at first I had seen it as any other flu, and thought that as long as I keep my immune system solid, I'd be fine and, you know, have gone about my days as always. However, as the news about the number of people who have been infected and the fatalities are released, I'm becoming a little bit more concerned, just like you guys. I remember prior years when my clients had a flu and it would come to my office. I would think, you know, I hope that I don't get it, but even if I do, 1 week later, I'll be fine. And even when I had a cold, I'm like, oh my God, even if somebody catches it, so what? They'll be okay. There's not an issue with it. Now there's a concern that lingers about getting the flu and transferring it to others. This is the first time in my life that I'm experiencing the fear of receiving, but more than anything, being responsible for transferring this virus to anyone else. Yet, I'm not sure when it would be wise to shut down all businesses and socializations for self and others' protection. So it's interesting that at a time of need, when we actually need each other, at a time when we're sick and we need someone to take care of us, this particular virus has all of us keeping away and remaining isolated. It's important to know that we're all connected in so many ways. Our connections, which can heal at this time, has turned into getting each other sick. However, let's keep our connections in a healthy way. Let's remind ourselves and others in our lives that we're here for each other. Even if they're sick, we can send food to someone and they can put it behind the door and then the person can go open the door and bring it in. We can, via FaceTime or any of the videos, we could Skype, Zoom, any of those, consistently be in touch with people and connect with them so they know that we're there for them. We will pass through this. I promise, like everything else we've passed through, every couple of years, we have something that is going to kill all of us, and then we've pulled through. So let's honor our own body and others by doing what we can do to keep being healthy. I'm not going to go over the stuff because I know you've probably heard it from everyone in what to do. Just take care of yourself and get yourself better and better and immune system higher. Anger, frustration, and fear just brings more stress to your body and weakens your immune system. Fear of losing what we have in life, our health, our freedom, the opportunity to be close, may also bring forth the appreciation and the gratitude of the beauty that we have, and maybe we took it for granted. So let's keep it calm and real. Protect yourself and others, honor yourself and others, and let's get through this together. We'll be right back with the latest research.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET 1490 AM.com.
Well, let me tell you really quick about the latest research. It's curious how an issue like climate change remains unsettled in segments of the population despite the overwhelming scientific consensus that human activity is responsible for the Earth's recurrent warming trend. Pick another one. Intelligent design and evolution, crop circle and possibility of extraterrestrial. How about information concerning the public health threat posed by a novel coronavirus? Now, what drives the lingering public doubt, despite the conclusion of credible expert? Part of the answer might be the story, or more accurately, failing to tell one. The narrative affects an audience perception of the person who's delivering the message. Melina Green, a professor in communication at Buffalo College, said that in some cases, ineffective messaging, it might be appropriate despite the aphorism to contrary to blame the messenger. Researchers wanted to explore why people are sometimes distrusting of what amounts to be the best possible evidence we have on many of them. Findings suggest that telling stories when communicating can make the speaker appear more warm and trustworthy as opposed to speaking some other way, such as providing only statistics and figures. So what they have found pretty much after working with 225 people participants, they found that when scientists are just talking and telling statistics, because the warmth does not show up, so just having a competence and knowing that the person has fact, they still look at it as untrustworthy. So the minute that the same kind of trustworthiness and the trustworthiness comes with the warmth, and the warmth comes with the story, even if you can say this story one way or another and then put in the fact in the middle, it seems like people kind of trust you and take it much easier to take it in your body. So if you want to give somebody fact, listen to it through the story. But the other side is you still need the facts. So even if someone's telling you the story or not, facts are facts. It's just not a story. So I wanted to tell you about our guest. We have already taped this because Dr. Zai could not be with me right at the live show on Monday. But he's an amazing, amazing psychotherapist. I've learned so much from him. This is Dr. Jeffrey Zeig. He's the founder and the director of the Milton Erickson Foundation, having studied intermittently with Dr. Erickson for more than 6 years. He edited, co-edited, authored, and co-authored more than 20 books that appears in 12 foreign languages. His current area of interest in extracting implicit codes of influence from various arts, including movies, music, painting, poetry, and empowering professional practices and everyday communication. He's the architect of the Evolution of Psychotherapy conferences, and he's on the editorial board of numerous journals and is a fellow of American Psychological Association. He's the president of Zeig, Tucker & Tyson, publisher in the behavioral science. And today we're going to talk about the habit of happy life and the concept of creating happiness, which all of us need, especially now. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Dr. Jeffrey Zeig. Well, welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zane, and I am so excited to have Dr. Jeffrey Zeig with us. I'm honored again that you're joining me in my program. Thank you.
Pleasure.
So let's talk about happy life. And I know that many of your books talk about positive addiction and how to create a concept of the behaviors, the thought process, the emotional process that would kind of ensure us that we keep creating a happy life for ourselves.
Sure. So we drive down an open road, but there are potholes on that road. And some of those potholes have to do with immediacy. What's the problem with instant gratification? The problem is that it takes so long. And so there's so many things out there that are potential potholes on our path. And these things are addictions. So a book that I wrote, The Habit of a Happy Life, along with Joan Nehal, actually, she's more the primary author of that book, but the essence of that is that if you can have a negative addiction, you can have a positive addiction. And so we talk about that book, about having positive addictions that can remove some of the potholes so that we have an open highway to have a better life.
So when we're looking at the concept of addiction, a lot of addiction, not only that there's a pleasure, you create a habit that attaches itself with the pleasure, and then beyond the brain chemistry, but from the psychological aspect of it, and then you keep going after the pleasure, and you get hooked in this association so much that no matter what the other issues and consequences are, somehow all of the other consequences take a secondary concept versus the original association that was there to the happiness. And
right.
The problem sometimes arises where when we're doing something that is awesome and it's great, like I'm supposed to exercise, that kind of association of pleasure just does not show up, because I think that right at the beginning, it appears to be pain before the pleasure shows up as the pleasure shows up as a consequence, but the experience of that moment does not associate necessarily to pleasure. So when you're talking about, you know, forming habits that are positive and shifting, how do you turn this
concept of, as you need to go through something and it doesn't shoot off as much dopamine, which you can really get hooked at the, you know, right up front.
Yes. So a couple of things. One thing is, how do we define addiction in the professional world, the medical world? How do we define addiction in the vernacular, the language that we commonly use? And some things that we say addiction, like an internet addiction, a pornography addiction, a gambling addiction, they're not addictions in the medical sense, where you have a chemical and you have tolerance and you build up tolerance to that chemical and you need more of the chemical to have a dopamine rush. But let's stay with the idea of addiction in the common sense that we use on the street, we use in everyday language. And you said that beautifully. So autonomy being a great motivator in human behavior, we are often subject to, I won't if I have to, even if I want to. I'll say that again. I won't if I have to, even if I want to. And so we can't generalize too far, but that's a common position. If you feel like you have to exercise, then that snaps us into an anti-autonomy world. Of feeling like there's something that we have to do. So you're absolutely right. We have to pair that with something that we want to do until it becomes something that moves from our working memory, we have to think about it, into our procedural memory. It's as easy as putting on our shoes and socks. We don't have to think about that anymore. We can have a conversation, put on our shoes and socks, and not have to think about it. So, like, for me, what we say in the book is to develop cross addictions so that you bridge from one addiction, positive addiction, to another. For example, I have a positive addiction about learning. Right now, for really no reason, I'm learning to speak Chinese. I just like the way it sounds, and so I want to study Chinese. The goal of living is to grow. The goal of living is to learn. So learning is interesting. And if it wasn't Chinese, I'd be learning something else. Well, now, when I exercise, which I do 360 days a year, when I exercise, I'm listening to Chinese. It makes me happy to learn Chinese. If I'm not listening to Chinese, I'm learning about something else. So I'm using one addiction to support another addiction. And a third piece of that is that in an overly socialized world, as a psychologist, where I'm spending lots of time intimately with people, it's nice to have that time alone. So the time alone, I think I'm exercising, but really I'm getting time alone. I think I'm exercising, but really I'm learning. And I'm exercising, but I don't realize that I'm exercising, and the time evaporates so quickly because I'm intrigued with what I'm learning. And if that were podcasts or whatever it was, it fits a value. Learn.
Choosing to be on the couch and then, you know, studying Chinese or being with yourself or meditating, you're saying, I'm choosing my body to be doing the exercising while I'm enjoying all the other things. And that's how you could associate the pleasure with some of the effort that you might want to do. And it appears to be, I have to do that.
One of my idiosyncrasies is being busy. I like being busy. So sitting quietly wouldn't appeal to me, even for learning. I have to be doing something. And exercise becomes a something, so that every day I'm learning something new. Not that I will ever speak Chinese. I never will speak Chinese. But I teach, and occasionally I teach in China, and I'll be able to say a few sentences and be able to, if I got lost in the middle of a small town, I'd be able to find my way to the hotel.
That's true. Uh-huh. So when we're talking about, so let's even look at the addiction as a conversation that we have. Is this something that we're looking at and calling it addiction because it's something that doesn't work for us? And is that why we're calling it an addiction?
Yes. The addiction becomes an eclipse. Mm-hmm. And then we can't see the path. I can remember poignantly a wife and a daughter, a grown daughter, brought the husband in to see me for a family therapy session. The husband knew that he was losing his memory, that he had brain damage from alcoholism. The wife and the daughter were beside themselves trying to convince this man that he was going to continue to lose his mind. He was continuing to lose his memory. He knew it, but he was not going to stop drinking. The immediacy of the pleasure of drinking was so great that the reality of losing his mind was not enough to set him on a better path. It's tragic, but addictions can be so powerful, so consuming, and in many ways they work. Don't think, drink. If you imbibe in chemicals, you don't have to worry about anxiety because the chemical blots out whatever trouble you're having at the moment. It's just that if you sweep enough things under the rug, eventually you'll trip over it.
Exactly. This part of the underlying cause in some work for addiction has been looked upon as anxiety, where if a person doesn't know how to contain their emotions, any of their emotions, but more than anything, the anxiety, it seems like completely paying attention and getting engrossed in some other activity or a substance at least numbs you for that moment. And then, you know, obviously right after it pops up and it never goes away. And even if you're not in an addiction mode, it seems like anxiety is one of those feelings, states, that really takes away happiness.
Yes. And anxiety is a disorder of being hyper-realistic. In order to get by in the world, we have to shroud ourselves in a collectively or personally acceptable denial. If you looked in your office, if I looked in my office at all of the potential threats, which could be pollution, chemicals, radiation, if I started to preoccupy myself realistically about all of the threats that exist, I would start to feel anxious. So somehow we have to shroud ourselves in a little bit of denial and not be so hyper-realistic about all of the threats that exist. The second thing about anxiety is that anxiety is a disease of the future tense. So if you want to be anxious, you need to push yourself into the future tense by saying, what if I get bit by a dog? What if the airplane falls out of the sky? What if I get a virus? And as long as you beam yourself into an unpredictable future and bring that unpredictable future into the present, you can be anxious. This is the Stephen King pattern. Stephen King would take a possibility that there's a pet that was angry and buried in a pet cemetery and wanted to get even and turned into a poltergeist and started to terrorize this small village in Maine. He would take a possibility and build it into a probability, something that could happen in the future, and suddenly you're terrified. A third thing about anxiety is that fear is realistic. There's a tiger at the door. Oh my God, that's terrible. And that's a fear, and that's a biological emotion. Anxiety is, Mr. Anxiety says, what if there's a tiger at the door? But the physiology of fear and the physiology of anxiety are the same. Whether there's a real tiger or an imaginary tiger, you still feel it the same way in your body. Fourth thing about this is that people think that the antidote to anxiety is relaxation. And that's not true. The way in which the human system is created by evolution is that arousal has to be immediate. But relaxation doesn't, from a biological perspective, need to be immediate. Think about it this way. If you go into a movie theater, dark adaptation takes 20 minutes for your eyes to fully adapt to the dark. Light adaptation is immediate. If you go from the theater into the light in a flash, you're adapted to the light. Well, if you're a caveman, you could spend time going into a cave and you wouldn't have to rush in. But if you were going out of the cave and there happened to be a saber-toothed tiger lurking there, you needed arousal to be immediate. So because arousal is immediate, people believe that relaxation should be immediate. And when they can't relax, it just makes the anxiety worse. So one of the things that people can do, usually best with some guidance, is to go into the anxiety, increase the level of tension. I know that sounds absurd, but if you felt anxiety in your chest or your stomach or in your face, that once you focused on the anxiety, tense up, increase the tension. The easiest way to tense up is to imagine that you have a nickel in between your knees and squeeze your legs together as if you were holding that nickel tightly. And that forces you to tense up the largest muscles in your body. Hold that for a count of three, let go. And keep on doing this tense, release, rather than trying to aimlessly relax and getting terrified because you can't relax quickly, which is a physiological impossibility unless somehow you've been trained to do that. Like a trained boxer could box intently for 3 minutes and then would be trained to have a minute of down regulation. But it's just so logical for people to think that they should relax, and commanding themselves to relax when they're in an anxious state, which in my years of experience is just not the best way of solving the immediacy of the problem.
But the physiological aspect of it, as I hear from you, is because physiologically what happens in the body and the arousal system is perking up. You're saying one of the fastest way to shift the body condition is the muscle tension and then relax, you know, let go, tension and let go. That starts working with the physiological aspect. The psychological aspect of it, what I'm also hearing that the anxiety is a concept of, let's say, the illusion of control, that we are somehow in control of every aspect that happens. So the fear shows up in, you know, when you say like, I'm hyper vigilant about reality, but there's also this piece of, if I'm hyper vigilant in reality, that means that I'm in the illusion that I can control every aspect of life.
Beautifully said.
When you're fearful about the tiger, I don't have to handle everything else in life. I only have to handle in the moment, how do I survive from that tiger? And that's it. That's the only control I'm about to do.
Fantastic.
So from a psychological place, how do we let go of that control? Because sometimes what I've done with clients is like what you were saying about the body, I overload them with this concept of being more realistic about that you can't actually control everything else that is. So let go. Sometimes sure. Overflooding of that allows them to just say, oh, well, screw it. Well,
the flooding is something that we all face. And if you amp your pulse rate in a situation that you perceive as threatening, you start to flood. Now, effectively, it's as if your brain is disconnected. And the fifth aspect of what I was going to take us to is, in an anxious state, don't solve problems. Don't try to solve interpersonal problems. Don't try to solve the threats that realistically exist in the universe. You don't have an integral brain. So the first thing to do is to get your brain reconnected. And the idea of doing this tense release cycle can help you to more quickly get your brain functioning. If this is the human brain, a diagram from our colleague Dan Siegel, and this is the spinal cord, the cerebellum, your blinking, breathing, digestion, your reptile brain, the thumbs would be your social brain, your mammalian brain, your limbic system. And on top of that, connecting all three is the neocortex, most well-developed in mammals, most well-developed in human beings. But when somebody is traumatized, it's as if the limbic system is firing and you don't have regulation that can be put into place from your medial frontal precortex. So you're acting from a fight, flight, freeze, fold, cling, biological condition. And you need time for your brain to be integral before you can solve problems. When people are terrified, Broca's area, the speech center, goes offline and people are struck dumb for a minute. They don't know how to speak. And probably most of us have had that experience. So you need to take the time that is necessary and have some mechanism that you can do so that you can reconnect your brain so that you can problem solve. When couples are tense and they're trying to solve economic problems or social problems with the children, but in that flooding, as you beautifully said, when people are flooding, they can't solve problems. They need to be able to get their brains integral so that they can have a fully functional brain to solve problems. The immediacy of the problem is to solve the anxiety.
So the anxiety, as the physical, physiological aspect of it, calms down the body and allows the brain to be reintegrated.
Exactly.
Having to face what is it that they really are anxious about, and is it realistic or not? Right. And then after,
and this is a bottom-up approach.
Right.
Don't try to solve things with your left hemisphere cognitively. Get your body working in your behalf, and work from the bottom up and not from the top down.
Okay. And then as you look at what is the imminent fear, and is it the truth or not, and what it needs to be done, because then it's more like figuring out what it is that you're really anxious about. Is it real? Is it right here? Is it imminent? You got to do something about it. And then the approach is looking at how to solve it, right? And then the solution building, is it more of, because there are some approaches of look at the worst case scenario and then see if you can be okay with it and you can solve it, or you can look at the concept of, well, you can't control everything, might as well, you know, let it be, or go through your strengths and look at your own resiliency, or have faith, or there are many perspectives of like looking at something that is out there and looking at, does it really need a practical concept, or is it, it's out of my control anyway, and there's only some things I can do, such as like if I'm driving or I'm in a flight, or you know, I'm afraid of death, or is some of these things where there's really nothing I can do about it.
Right. Give up the control, because if you try to over-control when you're in an airplane and you're afraid of being in enclosed space, or you're afraid of being at some height in the air, you can't control that. And so trying too hard to control is another avenue in which you can generate anxiety. So there has to be a moment of bringing yourself back to the present, rather than excessively orienting to the future. How can you get out of your mind and back into your senses? What's present in your posture, in your smell, in your taste, and in the tactile sensations that are immediate in the moment, what you see, what you hear? Jam yourself into the present so that you're not aimlessly exaggerating the realistic threats that are there, or aimlessly exaggerating by beaming into an unpredictable future. But the first thing to do is to reorganize your body. And then the second thing that you can do is to reorganize your perception. Basically, when I teach this, I just made a video, because three of my colleagues in China asked for me to make an anti-anxiety video for the Chinese population, which I did. And because some of my books, six of my books, more than six of my books, are translated into Chinese. So I have a following in China, especially within the professional community. And I was requested by three disparate colleagues. And what I outlined was a five-step procedure. A metaphor could be thought of as driving a standard shift car. The five steps for dealing with anxiety. Now, just as a preface to this, both of us as psychotherapists, we spend a lot of time with dealing with people who are anxious, and they could be anxious about many different things. It's almost axiomatic that whoever is capable of managing anxiety is going to win the game. It doesn't matter how gifted you are. If you take two athletes, let's say golfers, they're both professional golfers. They're relatively endowed physically with similar gifts. But whoever has the mental game is going to win the tournament, and that's the ability to manage anxiety. So having a habit of a healthy life is being able to manage anxiety and teaching ourselves to manage anxiety. And this is true in every form of psychotherapy as a fundamental piece of the equation of helping people is helping people to manage anxiety. It's true of being a parent, helping your children to deal adequately with the anxieties that are foisted on them from all ways in the world. So I outlined a five-step process. Step number one, information. What is the difference between fear and anxiety? What is emotional contagion? It's not just a virus that's contagious, it's emotions that are contagious. And people start to pick up on the fear, and that starts to disseminate. And it's a pandemic, not just of a virus, it's a pandemic of fear. So people need to have information. That's step number one. Step number two is to increase the level of tension. As I'm saying to you, work on your body, increase the tension. Step number three is to get into neutral. And to get into neutral is to do awareness exercises about getting into a neutral state. Think about it as a standard shift car. You need to have information about what are the road signs and how do you negotiate a car. Then you need to be able to get into the car. But if you're in reverse, you need to accept the fact that you're in reverse and then gradually shift into neutral, which is step three, to bring yourself into perceptual awareness. Step four in the process is safety. Well, there may not be safety if you're hyper-realistic in the immediate situation, but mentally you can do things to make yourself safe. Like we all have a happy place or a safe place or a memory of safety that exists. And if you sequentially review a memory of safety and you bring safety into your mind by sequentially reviewing a moment of being a little child and being snuggled into bed and somebody reading you a bedtime story and you feel so safe, but you review it in detailed sequential way and create this mentality of safety in your mind. From there, the fifth step is action. What action is appropriate for you to take? If you're dealing with an epidemic of a virus in China, you need to wash your hands. You need to know how to take care of your health. You need to know to wear a mask if you're in a public place. You need to know that building your resilience, building your health is going to help you to recover if you should get a virus. Health is the ability to recover from an insult and bring yourself back to home base. So now, you don't have to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to be able to deal with anxiety. Any one of those steps could be instrumental for any unique individual. But if you practice that, you know, for some people it would be they would be terribly anxious being interviewed by you. But we've done this so many times that we have institutionalized our energy so that we can be engaging for your audience. If you or I were in front of a group of 1,000 therapists and we were lecturing, we'd be fine because we have developed this. And in our procedural memory, this is something that we do. But to get there, to form a healthy addiction, a positive addiction, we may need to practice something a few times until it just drops into place and we don't have to think about it anymore. And we can do whatever it is that's immediately adaptive in the situation.
So going back to the five, information of what type mm-hmm. of emotion it is. The second one is...
increase the tension, go into the black hole. Even and if you can be paradoxical with yourself, just start to go, oh, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, lions and tigers and bears. That's from The Wizard of Oz, you know, where they're exaggerating their fear of going through the forest, but making it into something a little ironic.
Right.
So you don't have to take yourself so seriously. So that's step number two.
The natural, going to the neutral place.
And then step number three is neutral. Lose your mind, come to your senses. What's obvious now is that I'm talking to you and that you have blonde hair and a black dress. What's obvious to me right now is that you have a bookshelf behind you with objects and you have a picture on the wall. What's obvious to me right now is that I can hear my breathing. I can hear the sound of my voice. What's obviously to me right now is that I'm moving my hands, that my elbows are rested on the armrest. Just anchor yourself in neutral. You don't have to stay in neutral a long time, but you can't get from reverse into first gear unless you go through neutral.
And neutral is also present tense. So you need to go from the future tense to come back into the present tense. And then create the fourth one is creating safety. Even if you can look around and create safety, or in your visual sense,
Or your memory. Yeah, go to your safe place. Right. Build your safe place so that you can bring your mind into a better confirmation with what's happening. Your body is designed to react to things that are unsafe. You discriminate very quickly, and if something is coming at you, you take counteraction. If you grab something that's hot, you immediately remove your hand even before you feel it. Your body is designed to compensate for threat. And if you try to add thought into the immediacy of your body's instinctive reaction, it gets in the way. Animals don't have to think to protect themselves. And our cognitive ability doesn't help us as much as we think. We are animals and we're designed to right ourselves. We start to fall, we right ourselves. We don't have to think about that. And you have to realize that there's so many instinctive mechanisms that are built into your body that help you to deal adequately with whatever threat may be facing you.
And based on what you also said, I'm sensing that you're allowing the person to go calm down their physiological aspects. So based on neutrality and then safety, now they can look at action and see what it is they need to do.
Exactly. What would be adaptive? What is the right thing to do in this situation?
Versus the reactive right at that moment.
Based on having an integral brain.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we talked about addiction that is right here, and it doesn't allow you to live your happy life and look at the bigger picture of your life. Then we talked about anxiety, which puts you into the future tense and only looks at negativity, and then you know, it gets you hyper-aroused and reactive to life and doesn't allow you to feel happy. One more thing, which is then going to the past and living also in either the negative part of it, which then we bring it into the present moment and the future, or even people who live in the positive aspect of the past and keep getting disappointed about the present and seem hopeless about the future. So, which is usually what we call the state of depression, because they can go there and then just kind of like sit in the sadness and the grief and the sorrow and the disappointment, and which takes away their action, which it takes away from their present moment here, being present and enjoying, nor having any type of an action going forward.
Yep. Yeah, you said that beautifully. There's a book that was written by a famous psychologist, Philip Zimbardo, called The Time Paradox, where he discriminates personalities based on 9 different ways of dealing with time. So yes, if you want to be depressed, it's a good thing to beam yourself into an unchangeable past and bring that unchangeable past into the present. And your vocabulary would be, if only, if only, if only. And eventually you could ease yourself into a depressive state, and then that becomes familiar, that becomes procedural, and you just continue because of the inertia that you've created. It's like a mountain water, when the snow melts, it forms a rivulet, it forms a crease in the mountain, and everything keeps on flowing down that crease, and it just becomes a habit that that's the way the water will go, whether or not that's adaptive or not. So people get lost into a depressive mentality, and that becomes their style of being in the world, being into a depressive style. So time is really important. Now, let's orient, if it's okay with you, to something in the book about a resource state. If we think about that even one step before, a state of readiness. Now, readiness is a state that we can adopt to when we are in the mentality of forming a positive addiction. If you think about a golfer taking a practice shot, he's getting himself into a readiness state. If you think about a basketball player on the free throw line shooting an imaginary free throw before he has the ball, he's getting into a readiness state. So a readiness state for forming a positive addiction is, of course I can. So of course I can has a number of steps that I can break down in an artificial way, but it's basically getting into a state of, of course I can. There are, again, five traditional steps to getting into the state. I know I can eat healthfully. I know I can be kind to people. I know I don't have to get lost in my emotions, that I'm the architect of my emotions. I know I can. And then what are facts in the world that can help you? I know I can eat healthfully because I can read a book about nutrition. So I know I can. Facts is step number one. Step number two, I know I can. Motivations. I know I can eat healthy because I'll have a happier life. What are your motivations for doing this? Step number three is to change the sentence a little bit. I know I can because I am. I am intelligent, I'm strong, I'm motivated, I'm curious, I'm educated. And you're bringing together your personal resources. Step number four, I know I can, bringing together historical resources. I know I can because I've done difficult things before. I've had a child, I've climbed a mountain, I've earned a degree, I've worked hard. What are your historical resources? Step number five, social resources and perhaps contextual resources. I know I can, because I can get help from a therapist, I can get help from a friend, I can talk with my family. I know I can because I can put myself in this context, in this situation where I will be okay and I won't be suffering from cravings to do my addiction. So if you put together all of those five things, your facts, your motivations, your personal strengths, your historical strengths, and your social resources, and you bring those all together, you're in a readiness state. And then you can define what it is that you want for your positive addiction in a much, from a much better position. You're ready. And you've brought together your facts, your motivations, your personal strengths, your personal qualities, your historical resources, your social contextual resources. And if you bring those together and you have them right in front of you, then what you can accomplish is much easier because you have anchored this readiness state into your body. And then you can target where it is from there, where it is that you want to go.
Beautiful. Where can the people who are listening to us or viewing us find you, the videos you talked about as far as anxiety or your books?
Yes.
Jeffreyzeig.com?
Well, Jeffreyzeig.com would be one avenue, but Zeig Tucker, Z-E-I-G-T-U-C-K-E-R, ZeigTucker.com is the publishing company that published The Habit of a Happy Life. And some of my other books are there. My professional books are at erickson-foundation.org. And you can, E-R-I-C-K, Erickson, E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N, foundation-foundation.org. And some of my professional publications are published through that publishing site. But the book that would be most interesting is The Habit of a Happy Life, which is available on Amazon and available as an ebook. And it's even now available in Spanish as an ebook and will be printed in Spanish very soon too.
Wonderful. And you have two amazing conferences coming up. One is April 3rd to 5th in Burlington.
Burlingame, right? Just adjacent to the San Francisco airport.
Is the Couples Institute.
Couplesconference.com.
Couplesconference.com. And then in December of 2020, we have the
Evolution of Psychotherapy. Evolutionofpsychotherapy.com. And that's like Woodstock for psychotherapists. You've been there and you know this brings together the people whose initiatives have shaped psychotherapy in the latter half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. And we bring the greatest psychoanalysts, the greatest group therapists, the greatest existential therapists, cognitive therapists, hypnotherapists, and they all get together with the intelligent goal of finding the commonalities that underlie clinical work. Now that conference, the Couples Conference and the Evolution Conference, these are professional conferences. These are for professional education, and they're not things that are meant for the public. Like The Habit of a Happy Life is a book that's meant for the public.
Yes, thank you so much. I am so grateful to you for all that you do for our profession, and that all that I have learned. And you've been truly an inspiration and a motivation for me. So,
well, you've been reciprocally a motivation. So I thank you for what you're doing about making this knowledge available to your community and to people around the world. Thank you.
Thank you. And for all of you who are with us, listening and viewing us, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Until next week. Bye-bye.